We are talking once again with Geoff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon, good morning,
good afternoon,
good evening.
good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are.
Wherever you are, whatever time zone. All right, so starting out with local and Sheriff Ed Troyer making the news this week.
Yeah, he's in trouble, which he should be. He was charged by State Attorney Bob Ferguson this week with a criminal complaint saying basically that he made a misleading statement to law enforcement, which he did. He admitted to that on the night of this incident. This was an incident last January where he saw a young black man who was delivering newspapers in his neighborhood, followed him for several blocks in his car, and then confronted him, and then called into 911 that the man had threatened to kill him. And about 40 different law enforcement officers responded to the scene with the sirens blaring and all the rest of it. And the man said, look in the back of my car where there's all these copies of the Tacoma News Tribune stack. I'm doing my job. And Troyer was then questioned by investigators and admitted that he'd made the whole thing up. As BLM Seattle King County noted in its press release this week calling for him to resign, Troyer basically was trying to get the guy killed. And it's really kind of a miracle that cooler heads prevailed and they sorted it out and realized that the chief law enforcement officer for Pierce County was lying when he called that in. And then the Tacoma authorities did nothing about it. And so in last April, Governor Jay Inslee said that he wanted State Attorney General Bob Ferguson to take the investigation over, which he did. And so this week, Ferguson brought charges. And then on Friday, it came out that Troyer is now on something called the Brady List. What is the Brady List? It has nothing to do with the TV show. Has nothing to do with the Brady Bill. What this is a list that prosecutors in the state use to determine who is and is not a credible law enforcement witness in courts. So he made the Brady List, which is a list of law enforcement officers who were not credible witnesses, which tells you even before this criminal complaint, you know, goes through the judicial process, what prosecutors in the state think of Courier's credibility in all this. As the criminal complaint noted, he changed his story several times in the days and weeks after this incident. And there have been multiple calls for him to resign since then. He is still on the job. He's still getting paid. He's still the chief law enforcement officer in Pierce County, which kind of boggles the mind, honestly. And this was also not the first time that he's been accused of, shall we say, racially tinged incidents. So, Pierce County's got a problem, just like King County does, just like Seattle Police Department does.
Well, I know everybody is excited about this coming Tuesday being election.
Hey, you know what? Tomorrow is Halloween. The day after that is the Day of the Dead. And the day after that is Election Day, which seems like a natural progression.
It does, indeed. And we just want to remind people to not forget to mark your ballot and put it in the mail today, if you can, or Monday, if today is possible.
King County Elections actually recommended that if you're going to use the mail, try and postmark it by yesterday. Yeah. So I would say at this point,
Dropbox.
Put it in a Dropbox if you can. King County Elections, their website has a great list of where all the Dropboxes are around the county. There's a whole bunch of them. That's kingcounty.gov/elections, and I'll take you right to the elections page. And that will also... That also gives you information on how to register if you haven't done that yet.
Yeah, and if you haven't received your ballot, you can go to King County Elections, and there should be a link on their page for if you haven't received your ballot and you want to access your online ballot to print a copy and mark it up and drop in a ballot box. Also, if you want to register to vote, you can actually do that in person right up through Tuesday, Election Day. If you go to a vote center in King County in Seattle, the vote center is at Lumen Field at 800 Occidental Avenue South at the walk-in entrance on the corner of Occidental Avenue and Royal Brougham Way. They're open until 4 p.m. on Saturday. That's today. 8:30 to 6 p.m. on Monday and 8:30 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, Election Day. So,
I didn't actually get my ballot in the mail until yesterday.
Yeah. Wow. That's how bad the Postal Service has been. So if you haven't received your ballot, you can either go to a vote center. I would suggest you do that if you don't have online access, or you can go online and mark up and print a copy of your ballot to put in a drop box.
Yeah. And on a somewhat related note, how does Louis DeJoy still have a job?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
He's continuing to dismantle the Postal Service at pace, and it's really kind of a shame.
Yeah. So I think some folks are going to be pretty happy that Tuesday is the election, because then we'll all stop getting these annoying flyers in the mail.
Oh, my God.
Scary. Scary Halloween flyers.
I've been getting tons and tons of flyers for Bruce Harrell and for Ant Davison. And the Ant Davison flyers, I have to say, are a new low. They are some of the most misleading political hit pieces I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. I've gotten – apparently there's been at least four different anti-Nicole Thomas Kennedy flyers that are attack flyers with scary imagery. They're red and black with white print. And
of course, the flyers darken her up just to make the point.
Just to make her look like she might be either be a person of color or she's this scary, shadowy figure.
Yeah.
It's pretty disturbing and very, very annoying.
Yes.
I also noticed that Brett Hamill had posted on his Twitter account that one of those flyers, the last one, which I didn't get, probably because it had a misspelling on it. They misspelled the word public and they left out the L.
Ooh. Ooh,
ooh, ooh, ooh. So it says pubic on the flyer.
I thought, okay.
Well, you know, pubic safety is important.
Yeah.
Because if any of those scary homeless people get it anywhere near your pubis, you're in big, big trouble.
Yeah. Now, apparently a flyer sent out by the Harrell campaign or one of the PACs the PAC that supports him misspelled his name. So it's kind of all in keeping. I kind of saw that post by Brett Hamill and I thought, I wonder if somebody at the printers was messing with him.
Well, either that or they just weren't proofread very well.
Yeah, they just weren't proofread at all.
But anyway, yes. At this point, what public polling there has been shows Harrell leading and Nelson and in the city council race, and then who has also had some really gross flyers. Mm-hmm. And Davison appeared to be leading as well. That trifecta could really... I wasn't kidding about the Day of the Dead. That trifecta could really kill people over the next 7 years, particularly people looking on the street.
Yeah. So one of the things I found really annoying this election season, too, is that Sarah Nelson keeps tweeting pro-labor stuff. And I kind of wonder if Fremont Brewing is even a union shop.
I honestly don't think it is.
It is not, no. Yeah.
And The Stranger this week had a really great article, too, just very recently posted by Rich Smith on how Sarah Nelson and Fremont Brewing haven't followed through on promises they made for social justice initiatives they were going to do at Fremont Brewing in the wake of the George Floyd protests last summer. So that's definitely worth checking out if people have some time.
Yeah, Black Lives PR matters.
Right. Making promises you don't keep matters. I'm also pretty sick of Sarah Nelson trying to pose as some kind of social justice activist, too, when you go on the Fremont Brewing website and they brag about how green their company is, right? But when it comes to social justice initiatives, there's almost nothing on there. And Sarah Nelson, when you read her bio on the Fremont Brewing website, it calls her, and she's one of the owners, right? It calls her a longtime do-gooder. And I just kind of look at that and I think the last thing we need on the city council is someone who is so self-congratulatory, you know?
And who uses the phrase do-gooder anymore? That's like 1950s.
Yeah. Well, it's this specter of this, you know, white upper middle class person who is, you know, environmentally conscious and then thinks that that can substitute for being, you know, racist and classist and having politics that exclude a large portion of society.
Yeah, and the phrase do-gooder smacks of patronism.
It really does. Yeah,
paternalism. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which has really marked the city's attitude toward the less fortunate for decades. It's a very paternalistic approach and. It hasn't worked, obviously.
Yeah, I've also been really irritated by the way that Bruce Harrell and his supporters have gone after Lorena Gonzalez for one TV ad in which a white woman took Bruce Harrell to task for supporting Ed Murray when he was accused of molesting his foster sons. And
That was accurate.
The ad was completely accurate, but the optics weren't great. But they just castigated her for that. And Bruce Harrell has yet to explain why he was so quick to defend Ed Murray.
Yeah, and the people of color, like James Bible, that he trotted out to call Gonzalez racist for that ad, that was really discouraging. The other thing that's been discouraging is that all three of them have been touting their endorsements by Christian Gregoire and Gary Locke, which to me just... You know, it's triggering, right? Because I remember when Gregoire and Locke were governor and, how business friendly they were as Democrats. And now, of course, they're retired. They're on corporate boards and they're siding with their corporate paymasters, but people don't know that.
Yeah. I just kind of feel like, you know, somebody should have put their feet to the fire and said to them, are you going to withdraw your endorsement of Ann Davison? She's a member of the Trump right in the Republican Party. She actually gives a platform to these right wingers who supported the January 6th riot and are anti-maskers and anti-vaxxers and believe all these bizarre conspiracy theories.
For somebody who wants to be the chief prosecutor in Seattle, that should be disqualifying. Her lack of experience should be disqualifying.
Yeah.
Her hostility toward the dispossessed should be disqualifying. A lot of things should be disqualifying.
Well, the fact that she has no experience in court should also be disqualifying.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, instead, she has a pretty good chance of being the next city attorney, which is really kind of scary.
With the help of Gary Locke and Chris Gregoire. I really find that mind-boggling.
Yeah. You know. And much of the Democratic business establishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, happy Halloween, everyone. But yes, all that is to say that if you haven't voted yet, get out and vote. Do it this weekend if you can. Get your ballot to a drop box or if failing that in the mail and make your voice heard.
If you want to vote and you want to go down to Lumen Field, take some ID with you, go down there, register and vote the same day.
Yep.
As Jav has pointed out previously, it's the least one can do in changing our local politics and changing the world and having an impact, especially locally. And considering that city council races are often decided by a couple hundred, sometimes like less than 100 votes, it's really, really important.
Every vote counts.
Yeah, we have a long, long history of very tight city council races.
Very close.
That's almost one.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. All right. And don't expect Don't expect the results to be known on election night either.
It usually takes a couple weeks for them to get the votes counted.
Particularly because the more progressive candidates tend to be the one that make up ground as the ballots come in. Conservative voters tend to be the ones who vote early. And so that might be a factor in some of these races this year.
Well, let's move on to events at the Sausage Factory.
The City Council,
yeah,
where policy is made. Right now, the City Council is absorbed with the budget for next year. And this week, the council members started to roll out around 200 amendments to the mayor's proposed budget. A lot of amendments, as we knew, was going to happen. And I wanted to just talk about the amendments that are in two very broad categories. One is finance general, excuse me, and the other is public safety. Now, finance general refers to kind of the big budget picture, right? And there were two amendments there right off the bat that I want to talk about. Right off the bat, Teresa Mosqueda proposed an amendment that would reverse Mayor Durkin's effort to grab money from the Jumpstart payroll tax fund and use it for her own priorities in the budget. The amendment reallocates $62 million in funding back into the Jumpstart fund to reflect the council's priorities and allocates $97 million in funding for low-income housing out of the Jumpstart payroll tax fund, $14.3 million to the Equitable Development Initiative, $23.5 million to economic revitalization, and $14 million to Green New Deal programs. So that essentially restores how the funding was allocated out of the Jumpstart fund by the council in a budget ordinance last year, in July of last year. Then the amendment directs one-time COVID relief funds to plug holes in the general fund budget. Okay. This frees up money to provide one-time funding for the following three categories: $30 million for the mayor's Equitable Communities Initiative. That was the initiative that came out of her special task force to figure out where the city can spend extra funding for BIPOC communities. $30 million will go for participatory budgeting, which is a council initiative, and $17 million for community safety programs that were authorized by the council in 2021 but haven't been funded yet. Okay, these three programs all had money, about that amount of money budgeted for them in 2021, but because of the COVID pandemic lockdown, it's taking a lot more time to get those projects up and running and to get the money out the door. So they're going to have a lot of funds carrying forward to next year. And Mosqueda's amendment just tops those funds up to the $30-$30-17 million levels for 2022. Okay.
Speaking of which, has anybody asked Bruce Harrow whether he intends to respect city council's budgets?
No, I don't think they have. But that would be a good question, because Mayor Durkin hasn't. Mosqueda's second amendment that I want to talk about is a statement of legislative intent that the council will work with the new mayor, next year to find a new ongoing funding source for those three categories when the council tackles the next two-year budget in October and November of 2022. Her two co-sponsors on these two amendments, because these amendments all require at least one or two more co-sponsors, her two co-sponsors on these two amendments are Andrew Lewis and Lorena Gonzalez. Okay. So I think that's kind of interesting that Mosqueda said, nope, sorry. You can't just raid the Jumpstart payroll tax fund. That's a non-starter. We're going to restore the funding as we intended, and then we're going to use COVID relief funds to plug the holes in the budget and to fund your special projects. And then when we have a new mayor next year, we'll talk to them about finding a new ongoing source of funding, perhaps a new tax or a new fee to fund those projects, or maybe reevaluate the priorities in your that your administration has. So that's kind of been the council attitude so far to the budget. And we can expect that will go on.
Well, so, it's going to be a huge difference between the relationship to the mayor's office and the city council if Harrow is elected versus if Gonzalez is elected.
Yeah, that's very true. So I think the council at this point is basically looking forward to having Gonzalez in office, but I just don't think they can at this point count on that. So now the other section that I want to talk about, the kind of the big section that everybody's interested in, is public safety part of the budget. And that encompasses everything from the Seattle Municipal Court budget to the Seattle Police Department to the fire department, to the new communication center that runs the 911 call center and some other. First, the Seattle Police Department budget. There are 9 amendments to Mayor Durkan's proposed budget for the SPD next year, and I'm just going to talk about a few of them. Lisa Herbold proposed a request that the Seattle Police Department provide quarterly reports to the council on police staffing, overtime, finances, and performance metrics, including their data on hiring, on 911 response times, on their overtime hours worked, and other data that the Seattle Police Department gave the council on a quarterly basis in 2021. This would essentially continue a practice that Herbold instituted when she became chair of the Public Safety Committee, and the George Floyd protests brought up to the city council the need to take a deep dive into the black box of the Seattle Police Department budget. Her co-sponsors on this amendment are Alex Peterson and Lorena Gonzalez. So I thought that was kind of interesting that even though more conservative folks in Seattle are complaining that the city council is doing more oversight of the Seattle Police Department, that the more conservative member, one of the more conservative members on the city council, actually supports taking a closer look at what the Seattle Police Department is doing.
And a longtime staff person for a former cop in Tim Burgess,
which
is what Peterson did before he was elected. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's a good sign. And it's a sign that the city council is not on the wrong track, as so many of the folks campaigning for office this year, like Bruce Harrell and Ann Davison and Sarah Nelson, keep saying. Now, Lorena Gonzalez proposed a couple of provisos or holds or restrictions on funding in the Seattle Police Department budget. The first would put a hold on $5 million in salary savings that she expects the police department will see because they won't meet their hiring target in 2022. She estimates that the salary savings will be around $5 million. So she put a proviso on that to stop the Seattle Police Department from just taking that $5 million and spending it on other stuff. And that's something that the SPD has done in the past, is when they have salary savings, they don't just keep it there and set it aside. They'll just turn around and start spending it on other things. And then the city council finds out mid-year, oh, you already started purchasing new equipment, you know, or you
new surplus toys to the military.
Yeah. So this would put a hold on that money if there is up to $5 million in salary savings. Now, her second proviso would put a hold on $2.5 million for technology projects. The mayor's proposed budget would give the Seattle Police Department $5 million for 6 technology projects. Most of them are new projects that the Seattle Police Department has given out almost no information about, and that includes information to the council. And these have come as something of a surprise to the city council. This proviso would hold half of the funding for those projects in exchange for the Seattle Police Department submitting a technology plan for each project and an estimate of the costs and benefits of each new technology, as well as a description of what the technology is and what it will do. And I think this seems really reasonable, given that the Seattle Police Department has received millions for a new payroll and time tracking system that they still haven't implemented. They keep telling, whenever the city council asks them, well, can we see your overtime hours? Can we see who's working how much overtime? And the Seattle Police Department always comes back and says, well, you know, our employees are still submitting their time cards on paper slips. even though the department's received a ton of money to try to implement a digital digital time tracking system, they still haven't gotten it done. So this makes sense.
And the information on that in terms of how much they're spending on overtime looks really bad. So we don't really want to share it right now.
Yeah, right. And so Lisa Herbold and Tammy Morales jumped up and co-sponsored those two amendments. And they're all very invested, Gonzalez, Herbold, Morales, in making sure that the police department is actually spending funds the way the council intended. Now, Lisa Herbold had two amendments to cut funding to the Seattle Police Department. So these are cuts, not holds placed on funding within the department. The first would cut $4.53 million in salary savings over time, discretionary spending, and travel. And most of this cut is for the overtime budget for events and demonstrations. And even with a $3.2 million cut to overtime, the Seattle Police Department's overtime budget will still be 8% higher next year than it is in this year's budget. Lisa Herbold pointed out that through September 30th of this year, the Seattle Police Department had spent only $15.5 million on overtime. That's about 63% of the budget that the city council allocated for overtime for this year. So there could be salary savings on that end as well. And so the mayor's budget had just granted the Seattle Police Department like a 20% increase in overtime. And Herbold is saying, you're not even going to hit your overtime budget this year, and I don't think 20% is reasonable. So she's clawing back some of that money. Andrew Lewis and Lorena Gonzalez co-sponsored that. Now, the second cut that Herbold proposed is $1.09 million in hiring incentives. Instead, she would direct that $1.09 million to a citywide program for hiring incentives for all departments. And the amendment directs the City Budget Office and Human Resources to do an analysis of the benefits of a citywide program of hiring incentives and or look at other strategies to help with hiring personnel, especially frontline workers. And that includes, you know, the fire department, Medic One, as well as the Seattle Police Department. Teresa Mosqueda and Lorena Gonzalez co-sponsored that. Shama Sawant proposed a walk-on amendment. That means she proposed it just this week, not ahead of time, and no other council members have signed on to it yet, that would cut that $1.09 million and just direct the money back to the general fund, not to set up a citywide hiring incentives program. Alex Peterson also proposed a walk-on amendment with no other council members sponsoring it yet to add $2.14 million for one-time retention payments or hazard pay for police officers of up to $1,750 per sworn officer. And as I said, both of those last two amendments have not garnered additional sponsors yet. Mm-hmm. And we'll see.
I think we can see whose endorsement he's looking at come next electoral cycle.
Yeah.
So that's same money got last electoral cycle.
Yeah, so that's the police department budget. So as you'll see, there's no big effort to cut it by 50%. All right. The cuts the two cuts that are being proposed are cuts to the increase in the Seattle Police Department budget. And I think overall they would still have a net increase in funding next year. And there are reasons for that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. For the city attorney's office, there were two amendments. Lorena Gonzalez put a proviso or hold on $1.8 million in funding inside the city attorney's office to prevent whoever is elected as the new city attorney next year from spending that money on anything other than the three existing diversion programs that are currently being funded by the council through the city attorney's office. That's the pre-filing diversion program, the pre-trial diversion program, and the lead program. Her amendment specifically states that it's the council's intent to pass a law to make those programs a permanent part of the city attorney's responsibilities and the city attorney's office, written into the Seattle Municipal Code. this budget proviso would prevent Ann Davison, if she's elected city attorney next year, from cutting these programs if she takes office next year. But she could decide to just not spend the money that the council allocates for them, and that would starve those programs to death.
That's a strong contrast between her and Nicole Thomas Kennedy.
Yeah.
Thomas Kennedy wants to expand those programs.
Exactly. And that's why the council is going to be considering a law in December that would write these programs into the Seattle Municipal Code. So then it would be the responsibility of the city attorney to ensure that their funding stream is not cut off. Lisa Herbold and Andrew Lewis co-sponsored that very important amendment. Now, the second amendment in the city attorney's office, Lisa Herbold proposed adding $267,000 and four new staff to the city attorney's office to expand the pre-filing diversion program to adults who are 25 years old and over. It currently focuses only on adults age 18 to 24. And the reason that it does that is that most people age out of petty crime. Right. It's predominantly younger folks or younger adults who commit low level misdemeanors that are handled through the pre-filing diversion program. And when these diversion programs were set up, you know, they had limited funding and they had to draw a line somewhere. But that line is kind of arbitrary. There are plenty of adults in their late 20s, early 30s who also commit petty misdemeanors. And there are a significant number of folks who could be helped by a pre-filing diversion program. So this
it's one of the arguments for that program that because so many of them are young adults, it can really ruin future job prospects, et cetera. To
make it hard for them to rent an apartment, they can't get credit
to get wrapped up in the criminal justice system
at a young age.
Yeah.
When they do stupid things, you know, like shoplifting or they drive their car without renewing their license, you know, maybe they have a lot of disturbing the peace calls, you know, things that over and over again can add up, and eventually they end up in the criminal justice system and it can ruin their life, make it really hard for them to age out of the irresponsibility and become a more responsible member of society. So the idea is that if they can go through the pre-filing diversion program, which can help them get their life back into some kind of shape, then that can divert them out of the criminal justice system, be much less expensive for taxpayers in general, and just help those folks stay housed and in stable employment. Andrew Lewis and Lorena Gonzalez co-sponsored that amendment. Now, for the other public safety amendments, I'm just going to kind of group them all in one category here. Lorena Gonzalez proposed an amendment requesting that the city budget offices, Office of Innovation and Performance Management, get together with the Seattle Police Department and figure out if and when the new community service officers can start taking non-criminal 911 calls. Okay, this is the reason why the city council isn't cutting the Seattle Police Department budget more, is because the new community service officers have not started working separately on 911 calls. They've just been kind of acting as gophers for SPD officers. And she wants to get a report from the police department and the city budget office of when they think the new community service officers can start taking accident reports, referring people who are in crisis to city services, you know, when they can start working on missing persons cases, help to hand off cases to the LEAD program and do other work that Seattle police officers are doing now that just don't require a person with a badge and a gun. Tammy Morales and Andrew Lewis co-sponsored that very important amendment. Lisa Herbold has also proposed adding $1.8 million and 26 new staff to the new Community Safety and Communications Center, which houses the 911 call center. It has been understaffed for a while, and this would address requests made by the Seattle Police Department and by other divisions of the government that we add more staff to fully staff the 911 call center. Dan Strauss and Andrew Lewis co-sponsored. Lisa Herbold also proposed two amendments for the Seattle Municipal Court. One would do a study of fines and fees imposed on defendants to make sure that people are not being punished by the city for being too poor to pay their fines, and to make sure that those fines are not being waived in a way that that privileges white people and discriminates against people of color. Okay, that's a very important amendment. The other amendment would require the court to do a racial equity toolkit analysis of how court supervision is imposed on defendants in Seattle Municipal Court. That's very important, too, because studies have shown that municipal courts around the country tend to impose stronger and more intrusive supervision programs on defendants of color. And we want to make sure that there's not discrimination happening here in Seattle in that regard. Dan Strauss and Andrew Lewis co-sponsored those both of those amendments. Lisa Herbold also proposed a couple of amendments to the Office for Civil Rights. One would add money to fund a work group to study alternatives to incarceration for individuals accused of misdemeanor domestic violence, and would engage with survivors of domestic violence. This is super important because studies around the country have shown that more than half of survivors of domestic violence don't want to call the police when they're having an incident with an intimate partner. And so it becomes incumbent on asking the question of why don't they want to call the police, and what is it that police can't offer them that they need? So this work group would be looking into that and looking at alternatives to calling the police, and what the city can do to provide help to survivors of individuals accused of misdemeanor domestic violence. Tammy Morales and Andrew Lewis co-sponsored that. The second amendment that she proposed to the Office for Civil Rights would provide funding for that office to set up a community task force to assist the city auditor in an assessment of the police accountability system as a whole. And this is something that the city auditor has specifically requested from the council. The council tasked the auditor with doing that assessment, but the auditor has come back and said, well, I want a community group to provide feedback on what they think our current police accountability system is good at and what it's failing at. And this money, and I think it would add a person to oversee that, would really help with that. Tammy Morales and Dan Strauss co-sponsored that. And I think it is probably past due that the city take a look at whether our three accountability bodies are actually functioning the way they should be, like the Office of Inspector General for the Seattle Police Department and the Office of Police Accountability, because those two bodies we've seen this year in particular that there have been some complaints that they're not fulfilling their functions under the consent decree.
Yeah.
Now, that wraps up the amendments that I thought were very interesting in the public safety portion of the budget. There are lots and lots of other amendments. If you want to find information on those, you can go to the City Council's website and click on the committees tab at the top. And you can see that there are buttons for the budget committee, because that's the only committee that's meeting, and you can click on each day and an agenda will pop up and you can click into links on that agenda to read more about these amendments. And next week I'll talk about some of the amendments related to other things like housing and homelessness, human services, education, and maybe some other departments as well.
All right. And this process where they're proposing the amendments, that goes on for how many more weeks?
Oh, they try to wrap up the budget by Thanksgiving. So there's still two, three more weeks to go.
Okay.
This coming week, they're going to start, I think, tackling those amendments and voting on them, discussing them and voting on them one by one. So folks can, the city council is still having their meetings virtually. Mm-hmm. So folks can still sign up to testify at the beginning of each meeting, and you can listen in as they discuss and debate some of these amendments.
Yeah, and yeah. Some of it is really tedious, but some of it is fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. All right. Moving on. A jury finding this week that Geo Corporation wasn't...
Yeah. The Washington State Attorney General's Office announced that a federal jury has decided that the GEO Group, which is the private for-profit company that runs the Northwest ICE Processing Center in Tacoma, has violated Washington State's minimum wage laws. GEO Group pays detainees only $1 per hour to do non-security related work, such as janitorial, laundry, maintenance, and food service work at the Northwest Detention Center that was formerly done by civilian employees of the company who were laid off and replaced by detainees. In some cases, GEO...
And remember, detainees have not been charged with any crime.
They're not criminals. No. They are just being held in detention waiting for their immigration cases to be heard in court. Okay. Now, in some cases, GEO Group only paid detainees by giving them chips and candy in exchange for their labor. A number of the detainees had been complaining about the meager food rations inside the facility. The jury decided that GEO Group must pay the state's minimum wage of $13.69 per hour, regardless of who they employ. Now, the next step in the trial is for the U.S. District Court Judge Robert Bryan to decide on a penalty. He'll have to figure out how much GEO Group owes in back wages to detainees that they've exploited for at least the past 16 years. And
good luck finding some of those detainees because a lot of them have been deported.
Yeah. And if the company, and also he has to determine if the company should also pay damages to workers laid off and replaced by the detainees. In addition, Attorney General Bob Ferguson is asking the court to set up a fund, that could benefit job seekers in the area surrounding the detention center as well as current detainees at the Northwest Detention Center. The Northwest Detention Center is the fourth largest immigration detention center in the United States. Okay. And it's a crime. And I should mention here that it really is a crime to imprison folks who are not criminals and not being charged with a criminal violation, to starve them and then to enslave them and profit off their labor, which essentially is what GEO Group has been doing.
And this is like a perfect poster case for why private prisons are a really bad idea.
Yes. And this year, the state legislature voted to ban private prison facilities in Washington state. Currently, the state has a contract with GEO Group that expires in 2025. So the detention center is going to stay open until at least then. GEO Group has sued to challenge that law. But I think that this new court decision and the dirty practices that it has uncovered is going to impact the outcome of GEO's suit against the state. We'll just wait and see in that regard.
All right. Okay. Let's move on to this week's developments regarding the COVID pandemic.
Yes, it's still going on. I want to talk a little bit about something that happened in Portland this week. That didn't get a lot of attention up here. Eamon Bundy and his traveling band of brown shirt fascists, and I'm not slinging around that word loosely. They really are fascists. Showed up in Portland this week and shut down a Portland school board meeting with anti-vaccine, anti-mask demonstrations inside the courtroom. When the chair of the Portland school board asked people to put on masks, she was shouted down. She then said, well, I'm not going to endanger the people here in this room, so we're going to move this meeting to Zoom, which is what she proceeded to do. And as you can imagine, all heck broke loose. Now, why she didn't simply clear the room, maybe they didn't have the security on site to deal with that, I'm not sure. But Bundy is worth paying attention.
It might be hard to ask people who are packing weapons with them to leave the room.
Well, yeah, although I believe in Oregon, you can't carry weapons into a public facility like that. But, you know, so
that
what?
Doesn't always stop people from actually doing
it. No. But I want to talk a little bit about Bundy, because this is a regional problem. Bundy has become a darling on the authoritarian far right over the last couple of years. He's the son of Cliven Bundy, who you may remember led the standoff on a Nevada ranch with federal authorities some years back. And he was also key in the takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge and that arms standoff a few years ago. He has relocated in northern Idaho, where he has found a willing base of basically white nationalists to rally to his cause. And he has a lot of followers in Oregon and in eastern Washington and in Idaho, where he ran for governor unsuccessfully. On the Republican ticket, of course, and in Montana, and in BC and Alberta in Canada as well. So this is a guy worth paying attention to, and that traveling roadshow may well come to Seattle. So, you know, the Seattle School Board, which already has a pretty thankless job, better invest in security soon, I think, because this is going to be a problem, I think, in this area as well. And, of course, there have been plenty of incidents of anti-vaccine, anti-mask demonstrators. There have been a couple of very high-profile incidents on planes this week, which really one was in a flight from JFK to Orange County, California, where an anti-mask person punched a flight attendant and broke her nose. And so the flight had to be diverted to Denver so they could take her to a hospital and him to a jail before the flight went on its way. Another was on a flight, I believe, to Seattle this past week. These kind of unruly behaviors are becoming a real threat to flight attendants. It's become a real flashpoint for some on the far right to act out in this way. And, you know.
And I should point out, Ann Davison supports these folks, and she believes exactly the same thing.
And is supported by these folks.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's very, very disturbing. So, we're seeing a lot of this kind of acting out around the country, and a lot of the, you know, vaccine hesitancy is the same groups of people. I want to talk a little bit about the FDA, first an advisory panel, and then yesterday the full FDA approved the Pfizer vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds. So that still has to get CDC approval, which is likely to happen next week. So sometime in November, 5 to 11-year-olds will be eligible to get vaccinated. And that's going to be a huge deal, both for parents who want to protect their kids against COVID-19 and also as a flashpoint for people on the far right who want to target school boards and all the rest of it. This is going to be a big, big deal over the next month.
You know, I was just looking up you're talking about the flight attendant who just got punched. I didn't see anything in the original article about it being related to masking. And I'm now looking at several articles that actually say it was just because the flight attendant had bumped the passenger and they just went bonkers. So.
Oh, okay.
I'm not entirely convinced that is due to masking issues.
Okay.
Probably more white male rage.
Okay.
There's been a lot of that going around, you know, white male rage.
Yeah. Oh, there's plenty of that.
and I still think it's, you know, a related movement because we've seen, you know, over the past 5 years, I think Donald Trump did enormous damage just by the example that his boorish behavior set, giving people permission to act out in that kind of way. Whereas in the past, you know, you don't say the quiet parts out loud. You don't act out on your impulses like that. Now it's okay because we've demonized, or at least the people on the right have demonized folks that they disagree with in this country as being somehow less than human and less deserving of rights. And it's that kind of damage is going to take a generation or more to undo, I think. It's really unfortunate.
No disagreement there. All right. Let's move on. We just got less than 10 minutes left to cover multiple national items. I think we're all overjoyed that Facebook is rebranding slightly.
Yeah. I have to say that I'm really glad that Mark Zuckerberg made this announcement, because it gave the interwebs an excuse to just tee off. there's been a lot of hilarious takes on this. But yeah, Zuckerberg announced that Facebook was rebranding as Meta, so that he could create an alternate fictional reality where in the words of a Vice headline, Facebook is not a horrible company. And it's serving as a distraction from any number of different scandals that are rocking Facebook, particularly the revelations this week of a number of internal documents that have now been leaked, showing that Facebook was well aware of the toxic effect that the disinformation in its platform was having, both on elections and more broadly on things like vaccine hesitancy and all of the other
and even civil rights movements in other nations that were being shouted down and demonized on Facebook.
Well, not just civil rights, but I mean, for instance, in Burma, Myanmar, where you've had a minority there that has been the target of genocide, primarily through stuff that's been
social
posted
media
on Facebook. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Facebook has been the primary platform for that. Same kind of thing has been happening to a lesser scale in the Philippines and some other companies where Facebook
other countries, yeah.
Where Facebook is absolutely dominant in terms of social media platforms. You know, Facebook really is a global enterprise, and
yes, that internally they were aware, they'd done studies. Zuckerberg just made the decision that marketing and the company's growth was more important.
Yeah, and so you know, the fact that the company was already wildly profitable, Zuckerberg has always wanted more and has refused to take any kind of socially responsible steps that might curb that growth.
So my response to their rebranding as Meta is, why didn't you just change one letter in that and call yourselves Mega, since that's the real drive here?
Pretty much. Or you could call yourself, SpaceX. Because it's that kind of billionaire arrogance that's reflected. Uh-huh. Why not just merge them all into one company and rule the world?
All right. And Kyle Rittenhouse is looking at trial.
His trial has started in Wisconsin. Kyle Rittenhouse, you may remember, was the then 17-year-old who shot and killed two protesters in Kenosha last summer. And then walked away from the scene past multiple law enforcement officers, shotgun in hand, still smoking. There's plenty of video of this. And then crossed the state line to his family home in Illinois and didn't turn himself in for, I think, a couple of days. So this week, the judge in that case decided that the people that Rittenhouse shot and killed cannot be referred to as victims, because that's prejudicial. Since Rittenhouse's defense is that he was self-defense. Now,
prejudicial against Rittenhouse, I should point out.
Yeah, and
because you can't do anything to offend white boys, right?
Yeah, and there's plenty of video, again, that shows that it was not self-defense. You just shot them in cold blood, randomly. The prosecution then countered, Rittenhouse's defense attorneys are using prejudicial language, too. But the judge then ruled that calling the people that Rittenhouse shot rioters, looters, or arsonists could stand. That was okay. Which is also not factually accurate. Now, mind you, during the unrest in Kenosha, there were plenty of rioters and looters and arsonists, but that was in downtown Kenosha. The shooting actually happened a couple miles away from there in a march through the western side of Kenosha, and it was an entirely peaceful march. There were no fires, there was no looting, there was no arson, but and so by definition, the people that Rittenhouse shot can't be accused of that. at least not at the time that they were shot. So this is the way the trial is going. Rittenhouse, of course, has been become a cause célèbre on the far right for his vigilantism last summer. And his defense fund has gotten several million dollars, I believe, at this point. And this is the way the trial is going, which it wouldn't surprise me if that's the precedent to see him acquitted of shooting those men, which is
unfortunate and outrageous.
Yeah. But, you know, you wouldn't want to ruin what was a promising future for a young budding fascist. white fascist, I should say. So, yeah.
All right. And finally, the G20 came out with...
Yeah, Joe Biden left the struggle to try to pass an infrastructure and finance bill, a very important expansion of social programs bill in the U.S. House and Senate to attend the G20 meeting this week. And the news just last night was that the U.S. and other members of the G20 had endorsed a global 15% minimum tax on corporations. Finance ministers from 140 nations around the world have agreed to that deal. But of course, it's going to have to be passed into law in each individual country for it to take effect. All that takes really to scuttle an agreement like that is for one or two holdouts to say we're not passing it, right? And to provide a tax haven for major corporations. But in order to get around that, the agreement includes an enforcement provision that would allow the countries where a corporation is headquartered to impose tax penalties if a corporation does go below that 15% minimum. But again, that garnered a lot of criticism from lower income countries like countries in Africa and in Asia where a lot of those global corporations do the production of their goods, you know, where they have factories where their goods are assembled and produced. Those countries are complaining because, well, that means that the corporation that's headquartered in the U.S. or Europe, those countries, the U.S. and countries in the European Union, would be able to get all of the income from that tax, from those tax penalties, and none of it would come to the countries where those corporations have their factories. So that was one of the complaints against this. I should also say, too, that the new 15% minimum tax would only apply to companies with more than $850 million in revenue. So it's meant to just apply to the very biggest of the large multinational corporations and would still allow a lot of very large companies to get off the hook and pay less than 15%. But it's also the question of would Congress here in the United States raise the corporate minimum tax? Because currently it's under 15%, and a whole lot of corporations, large and small, pay zero in income taxes. So that's an open question too. We're seeing right now that it's really, really difficult even for House and Senate that have Democrat majorities in them, albeit very slim majority in the Senate, to even pass, you know, major portions of a Democratic president's agenda. So we'll see if this can pass here in the United States. And all it would take really to scuttle the deal is for one of the major nations who have signed on to it, one of the G20, like the United States, for example, to not be able to pass it in their parliament or Congress in order to scuttle the deal.
I'm very, very skeptical that it could get through the Senate.
Mm-hmm. It's a good idea. We'll see if it can actually become reality.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time.
Yeah.
We'll return to this next week and probably have the initial
Results of the election.
We'll have an election to deconstruct. Yep.
We'll have an election to talk about.
Fun.
And we'll have some more budget stuff to talk about.
Very good.